Alaska became a state 55 years ago, but even 100 years before that, some had their eyes on it. Good morning and welcome to Talk of Alaska. I'm Steve Heimel. Today, a trip through history as a biographer tries to set the story straight about William Henry Seward. You can call toll-free at 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK, statewide, toll-free. A local call on Anchorage at 550-8422, or email talk@alaskapublic.org. The times and conditions that gave rise to the Alaska Purchase. The subject today on Talk of Alaska Statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by First National Bank Alaska, earning Alaska's trust for more than 90 years. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC. Enjoy a lunchtime talk with former Google Energy Policy Executive Dan Riker on Friday, May 2nd during the 2014 Business of Clean Energy in Alaska Conference at the Dena Center. Hear how Alaska can become a world leader in the fast-growing renewable energy industry. Individual tickets for this keynote luncheon can be purchased at bceaconference.com or 929-7770. Clean energy, it's everyone's business. This message sponsored by REAP. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
Our telephone number again, 1-800-478-8255, and we have two historians with us on this program. One of them is already familiar to probably a lot of our listeners, and he's been a guest on this program several times before, Professor Emeritus at University of Alaska Anchorage, Stephen Haycock. Steve, welcome back.
Gosh, thank you. Pleasure to be here.
And Steve is the author of Alaska, an American Colony, which touches directly on some of the same things that the other book touches on, Seward, Lincoln's Indispensable Man. The author of that book is Walter Starr. He teaches in Exeter, New Hampshire, from where he joins us by telephone. Walter, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Great to be here.
Yeah, I'm glad to have you on this program. I'm glad to be discussing this this crazy era in which Alaska was purchased, and the vision that Seward had at that time and long before that time, really, and where in the world that came from, I have really not a whole lot of idea, but I hope you do. And what Mr. Seward might make of Alaska if he were to see it today is another, I think, really great question. And maybe even the one that I will ask you first, Walter Starr. What do you think would most surprise William Henry Seward if he could just walk out of the pages of history into, let's say, Juneau, Alaska, during the legislative session?
Sure. Well, perhaps I should preface by saying that Seward not only purchased Alaska, but he visited Alaska. Not long after his retirement, he went west and then went north and spent a couple weeks in Alaska, Sitka, on north from there. And he gave a speech in which he predicted that Alaska would soon become a state, and indeed that it might well become several states because the territory was so immense, that it would fill up just in the way that Ohio had filled up during the course of his lifetime. So I think his main surprise would be that Alaska is so empty.
Wow.
I think if he could, you know, if he could rise up from the dead and you could ask him some questions about Alaska before he had a chance to check the internet, he would predict that its population would be, I don't know, 3, 4, 5 million people. Not its current population.
Yeah, that is a really cool one, and I suspect that will be provocative to our listeners. And Professor Haycox, I want to ask you the same question. What do you think would be the big surprise that Mr. Seward would see in Alaska if he were here today?
Well, I don't think he would be surprised at the functioning of the Alaska legislature. I think it would remind him a bit of what he was familiar with in Washington. And people, of course, have been waiting for Alaska to fill up since Seward's time. They're still waiting. I think what would surprise him, I think he would be absolutely astonished at the way that Alaska Native people, who are a fifth of the population of Alaska approximately, are so fully integrated into the political, social, and economic life of Alaska. I think he would be completely unprepared for that.
Now, this is a man who really welcomed all sorts of immigration. I mean, that was a consistent policy throughout his career as Secretary of State, Governor of New York, and so forth. He always wanted immigrants coming in. So what would it be about Alaska Natives that he wouldn't think of them that way?
Alaska Natives were outre. Any American indigenous were outre, were other, in the middle of the 19th century. The best policy that anyone could imagine for them, aside from extinction, which many people expected, was full acculturation and loss of cultural identity. They needed to become, in the policy of the time, if you will, culturally imitation white people. And that's not the way we imagine their future to be today.
Now, Walter Starr, I think I want to say there is culture shock when you go back 150 years in history towards people's attitudes. I mean, I can see it in the space of my lifetime, which is, you know, less than half of that. You know, the attitude of race, attitude towards substances have changed radically. Attitudes about gender roles have changed unbelievably, and so forth. And you go back that far, you're just dealing with a different culture. And with that in mind, Walter Starr, I want to ask you about Seward's life as a landlord. Before he even became governor, he was in charge of a huge hunk of land that, by my accounting of history, was actually part of the Six Nations. And indeed, even now, the Corn Planter Reservation sits in that land that he used to be in charge of. What? How does that work? Is this just this sort of sweeping aside the savages and bringing civilization to the continent?
Well, it's interesting. Yes, he's land agent for a couple of years, kind of between his term as state senator and his term as governor, for what we now think of as the six western counties of New York, which, as you say, had and have Native Americans. I can't think in that little period of any letter of his that deals with the Indians. He did deal with them as governor, and as Steve was saying a minute ago, he didn't have any very good answer as to how the American Indians were going to survive. He sort of hoped in a naive way that they would, as Steve was saying, kind of become, like white Americans and just meld into white society. But he didn't have any really strong hope in that direction, because the experiments that were being conducted in that way were not working very well at all. But that period as land agent, I can't. If I went back and dug and dug and dug, I might be able to find something, but I can't think of anything that I found in my research. He was mainly dealing with a bunch of very unhappy tenants who thought the rents were way too high and were rioting and burning the land office, and he was trying to steer some middle course and collect rent without having his own head scalped.
Yeah, I think we cannot speak of the era of William Henry Seward without talking a good deal about slavery, the issue of slavery, and the fact that that part of New York was among the more liberal in that regard in the United States. And I wonder, Walter Starr, if you came across in your researches the whole notion of that area of Western New York State where Seward ended up settling and living out the end of his life and was landlord, referred to as the burned over area, where there were two waves, really, of great awakenings, great religious revivals that swept across the continent, and people wanted to get right with God, and that was particularly the case in this part of the country where he lived, like in Rochester and Seneca Falls and so forth like that. And even today, there are, you know, remnants of that. I mean, actual religious sects are still centered in that area.
Yes, absolutely. It was a a hotbed of religions, plural. When Seward went to Salt Lake City late in his life and met with Brigham Young, Young said, "Now you don't remember this, but as a carpenter, I worked on your father's house. I'm sorry, father-in-law's house. Built a." And Seward said, "Yes, I do think I remember that." So, among other religions, Mormonism had its starts in upstate New York. And as you say, that religious fervor led to fervor on other issues: women's rights, black rights, temperance. A whole host of social issues are sort of centered in that part of New York, as well as religious issues.
And so we have Harriet Tubman living there. We have. Frederick Douglass in Rochester, and actually Seward knew these people.
Oh, absolutely. Seward was Tubman's landlord. Seward, in addition to serving out in the western part of the state, he owned quite a bit of land in Auburn, New York, where he built sort of modest homes. Largely owned by free blacks, and Tubman was one of those who purchased from him on very, very easy terms. And when she didn't pay as required, he didn't, as best I can tell, didn't bother her much to make payments.
I think she carried a gun. I heard that one time.
Well, in a way, she should have, because what she had done, not only freeing herself but helping other slaves to free themselves, was a crime, and it was not uncommon for free blacks to be, as it were, kidnapped in New York and elsewhere in the North and taken back to the South into slavery.
Yeah, it's for whatever, I don't know the, what is it, 12 Years a Slave? Is that the Academy Award winning motion picture? And it deals with a kind of an earlier time, but that exactly happened to this guy. Exactly,
yes.
Happened to him. And I don't think he'd written his book except that he couldn't get any recourse through the courts. And
right.
So he had to get his story down some way. And it must have been a popular tome amongst the abolitionists, because it is ridden with stereotypes. And I'm not sure it would be all that accurate. But as a document of the times, fascinating.
Yes. Yeah, no, but these were, how to put it? Slavery was an intense issue, North and South, in part because people could be sort of kidnapped from freedom into slavery, and people conversely could free themselves if they were clever enough and lucky enough and get to Canada and make a new life for themselves.
Well, it's really interesting to me. I wanted to take a little while on this issue of slavery first, because it seems sort of trendy that everybody's been kind of reexamining all this history, and to get a feel for the alienness of the era, and also to get a feel for who this William Henry Seward was that brought us the Alaska that we know to a great degree, and envisioned it even. Pretty crazy. And I want to get to all that. But I also still need to push this a little further, and that was this business of abolitionism, because Seward was sometimes called an abolitionist, and his wife was an abolitionist, but by the parsing language of the times, you were not necessarily, if you opposed slavery, you were not necessarily an abolitionist, right? Could you explain that to me?
Sure. Another way of putting it, perhaps, is that abolition encompassed a broad range of different views. On the one hand, you had people like Frederick Douglass, who thought that slavery was wrong and that it should be ended yesterday and the federal government should do it. But then you had a lot of folks like Seward, like Lincoln, who were sort of moderates, if you will. They thought slavery was wrong. They thought that it should not be extended into the western territories, California, New Mexico. But they thought it should be left alone to kind of die of its own weight in the southern states, and that the Constitution gave the federal government no authority to terminate slavery in the southern states. That's sort of a lawyerly complicated position, but and I think it, in some ways it's easier to say that, that people like Lincoln and Seward were not abolitionists. They were gradualists or abolition over a long timeists. But that was the official position of the Republican Party in 1856 and 1860, and indeed remains Lincoln and Seward's position through the early months of the Civil War. It's only really the war itself that causes Lincoln and Seward to change their minds and causes Lincoln to issue the Emancipation Proclamation.
And just to sort of bring the slavery thing to a close, which we can't do because it hangs through the entire narrative, but nonetheless, there's pretty good evidence, is there not, that Seward actually, his actual estate was used as part of the Underground Railroad at least once.
Yes.
And that's that's a violation of the law, right?
Yeah, it's a violation of federal law. And but yes, there are letters from Seward to his wife and vice versa talking about fugitives staying at the Seward house there in Auburn, New York. In one of them, Seward jokes that the family dog was not too happy about the presence of a couple of fugitives down in the basement.
Wow. We have Walter Starr, author of Seward, Lincoln's Indispensable Man, and Steve Haycox of the University of Alaska Anchorage here with us. Our telephone number is 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK. A local call from Anchorage at 550-8422, email talk at alaskapublic.org. And the purchase of Alaska, Walter Starr, comes about when basically Andrew Johnson is president. Lincoln's been assassinated, and Johnson is, this is all happening at the same time that they're trying to impeach Johnson for reasons that to somebody in my distance of history are really unclear. And I think they were a little unclear to the Congress because they just wanted rid of the guy.
Yeah, now one congressman was quoted as saying, if I could impeach him for being a damned cuss, I would do it. But I'm not quite sure what the real grounds are.
but it is, it's completely entangled. In order to get to purchasing Alaska, we also had to get through this whole business. And then we get to whether or not there was bribery and all this. It gets pretty crazy.
But before we actually get to that, I wanted you raised a question earlier as to, you know, why was Seward interested in Alaska? And I think maybe we should talk about that a bit before we get to the nitty gritty of the purchase, because I think that's an interesting and important subject.
I agree wholeheartedly, and Professor Haycox does as well.
Indeed.
Sitting here very very quietly, you know, nodding his head and smiling.
Indeed, I work at it. Well, a generation ago, two major American historians, William Appleman Williams and Walter Lefevre, argued that Seward's appetite for Alaska had a great deal to do with economic and even a little strong to say, but military imperialism.
He used the word empire all the time.
Well, he used the word empire all of the time. He was a visionary, I think much more visionary than probably anybody else in Lincoln's cabinet, with the exception of Lincoln himself. And part of his vision was the expansion, America's economic expansion into the East, into the Orient. There are some interesting quotes. He made a speech up in Massachusetts in which he talked about the coming century and America's turn to the East, not leaving Europe out, but adding the East on. And he wanted some forward bases that would facilitate both military and commercial shipping. They needed coal to fuel the ships, and they needed water. And perhaps a little bit of land time for the crews. And there were a number of places that he thought would be ideal for that, and Greenland was one. He had his eyes on Greenland. He didn't get Greenland, although perhaps with the American leases for bases there, he did just as well. He wanted St. Thomas in the Virgin Islands, and eventually we got that. He wanted Alaska, and he got that. He was thinking about Hawaii already in the 1850s. He's thinking about Hawaii, and that would eventually happen. He was thinking of a Panama Canal, as Walter has reminded everybody, I think, that in his book. So he had this notion of America expanding. And I think that Alaska fit right into that notion of where America should be going in the next century.
And Walter Starr, as I understand it, he was speaking of this kind of thing even before the concept of manifest destiny was articulated.
Yes, I found this wonderful quote, and I thought, gee, that's manifest destiny. And then I sort of said, well, wait a sec, and I dug into manifest destiny a bit, and Seward actually sort of predated manifest destiny a bit. Although, paradoxically, he's also, as a kind of standard Whig politician, he does occasionally in the 1840s, especially at the time of the Mexican War, caution that America doesn't really need any more land. So after the Civil War, as Steve is saying, becomes much more ambitious. I think the war itself, in a way, changes his views. He realizes that maintaining the blockade of the southern states, you can't really do it just from the ports of the United States, that you need ports in the Caribbean, and you need a canal to get back and forth to the west and to what we call East Asia, Japan and China.
You know, these were very dynamic times naval-wise. I mean, you just read about, the naval history and the number of vessels that could be taken. There was some tremendous success, the Alabama, tremendous success by some of these Confederate vessels. It was all changing, and if you demonstrated your power, they would surrender, otherwise they'd sink you.
In 1841, the United States sent a small fleet around the world. It was captained by a guy named Charles Wilkes, the U.S.-American naval round-the-world expedition. They did some very interesting work in South America and in Antarctica. They penetrated Antarctica more deeply than anyone else had. They actually got into some trouble on the West Coast. They lost a vessel trying to cross the Columbia River Bar, which was part of the story of the acquisition of Oregon. And as Walter has reminded us in his excellent book, Wilkes, of course, was the fellow who almost got us into trouble with the Trent Affair.
The Trent Affair?
Yes, the brief version of the Trent Affair is that Wilkes got wind that a couple of Confederate diplomats were on their way from the South to England. That they were on a boat headed from Cuba for London. He happened on the boat, shot across its bow to force it to stop, seized the diplomats from the deck of this British commercial ship, and then let it go on its way. That ship was the Trent. And when he gets back to the States, he's hailed as a hero. But when news of this reaches Britain, he's denounced as a villain, and there's a demand from the British government to the U.S. government to turn them over and apologize. And Seward brings Lincoln and the cabinet round. They're very reluctant to do so, but he forces them to see that to try to conduct a war against the rebels and the Great Britain simultaneously was to, in essence, give up on the rebels, that we just couldn't do it, and that it was better to apologize and bow low and to the British, in this instance, in order to maintain our focus on the Civil War.
He talked him into it. That's what's so amazing about this guy.
He talked him into it. Yes, we have a draft in Lincoln's handwriting of what Seward should say to the British government, and basically what Lincoln thought Seward should say was, well, let's have an international arbitration, and let's put all of the facts and the legal arguments in front of neutral arbitrators and agree to abide by whatever they decide. And Seward knew that the British would just view that as kind of a lawyer, you know, trying to buy time, and that there was a very high possibility that the British would declare war, that they meant it when they said, hand them over, and they meant it when they told the British minister in Washington that he had 7 days to get a response, not a day longer.
To be a yes or a no.
It had to be a yes or a no. And so Seward was able to, these cabinet meetings occur on Christmas Day and the day after and run for a long time, but Seward was able to kind of bring Lincoln and the cabinet round to his way of seeing it, and it was Seward's answer, not Lincoln's, that went to the British, and it said, we will cheerfully hand them over.
Well, of course, Alaska ends up to be a kind of a resource colony for timber mining, oil, notably oil, and fish, and on and on. And I'm wondering if that's what Seward really was looking at. I'm getting from what you guys are saying that his notions may have been more military.
He certainly was interested in the resources. He felt the resources were going to be tremendously useful, but I agree with Steve that he saw it not just as sort of an end in itself, but as a stepping stone to other things.
It's a stepping stone to Siberia. There's nothing there.
If you think of the Japanese Current, though. I mean, for a long time, the Spanish had been sailing across the Pacific and coming back over, just brushing the bottom of the south edge of the Aleutian Islands, if you will. So it was pretty realistic, I think, the way that he was imagining Alaska to fit into that picture.
Yeah. And or think, you know, he couldn't have necessarily envisaged it, but for a long time, if he wanted to fly from New York to Tokyo, you went to Anchorage. So I think that as a stepping stone, and we haven't mentioned, but we should, that he also saw it as kind of a, how to put it, in chess terms, an advanced position that was going to help him pull in something between the United States and Alaska, namely British Columbia. He felt that if the United States could secure Alaska from the Russians, that it would strengthen the American hand in securing British Columbia from the British, and he didn't get there. It's like a lot of other territorial acquisitions. He tried, but didn't get there. But he got closer, I think, than we remember to securing British Columbia from the British.
I guess if the people in British Columbia could have had a vote about it, it probably would have become part of the United States.
If the newspaper accounts, the handful of newspaper accounts that we have, because there weren't a lot of newspapers even, people in British Columbia were very unhappy, and annexation to the United States looked pretty good.
Wow.
The British moved quickly to prevent the development of a democratic government in their crown colony of British Columbia. And part of the reason was that they were very anxious about the potential for annexation to the United States.
And I guess we shouldn't forget there had been a gold rush in California. So there were all these people in California. And there was a notion of expanding the nation in that direction. And there was also gold in British Columbia, right?
1858. There was a rush in 1858 up above where Hope, British Columbia, is now on the lower Fraser River, very significant, and most of the gold rushers, if you will, were not Canadian or British Columbian, they were American.
And then Juneau happens when?
Juneau doesn't happen until 1880, but it moves on up. There is a strike in the Stikine in the late 1860s and then into the 1870s. So you can, by looking at the dates of those strikes, you can trace the interest in mineralized potential moving northward inexorably.
Wow.
But indeed, at the time of the purchase, there were reports that there was gold in Russian America. When I saw these reports, I thought, boy, the Russians, if they'd had any clue, they would have demanded more than they did for Russian America.
No, the Russians were very aware, and as a matter of fact, they had conducted extensive exploration in what is now Resurrection Creek, very near Anchorage, across Turning an Arm, and had found shows of gold. But they recognized, as a number of people who came into Alaska after the purchase did not, that they weren't sufficient for a commercial operation. But no, there were 60-some Russian scientific voyages to Russian America between 1741 and 1867. There was voluminous material about Alaska's resources. The Russians had done everything they could to develop alternative resources in Alaska. They tried mining coal on the lower Kenai Peninsula, for example, and that had worked for a year or two before much, much better coal was discovered in what is now Washington State. They tried whaling. They established a whaling company and hired a bunch of Finns to go competing with the British and American whalers in the Bering Sea whale fishery, but they didn't put enough money into it. When Peter Golovin compiled a report in 1862 for the Tsar and the Tsar's advisors about what to do with Russian America, he pointed out that the Russians had tried pretty much everything they could think of in Russian America, and none of it was working.
And the supply lines were very, very long.
That was a huge problem. They couldn't defend the place either.
Yeah. This is fascinating. We're talking with Steve Haycox and Walter Starr as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from Providence Imaging Center, with its newest center in Soldotna, offering CT scans, MRI, ultrasound, and digital X-ray to residents on the Kenai Peninsula. Learn more at provimaging.com. If you're ready to quit tobacco or just thinking about it, the coaches at Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line, a free service for all Alaska adults, can support you with Text to Quit, with tools to make your quit attempt successful. Text to Quit helps you stay in touch with your quit coach, use nicotine replacement medications properly, manage those urges to use tobacco, and prevent relapses, all from your mobile phone. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
Alaska, an American colony. The author of that book is with us today, and also the author of Seward, Lincoln's Indispensable Man. He's the man that made Alaska the American colony, Walter Starr. Walter is with us by phone from Exeter, New Hampshire. And how's the book selling, Walter?
Well, it's done pretty well for a book of its type. It's not going to... it's not going to put Dan Brown, another local author here, out of business, or even make him lie awake at night. But it's somewhere north of 20,000 copies at this point.
Well, your prior book about John Jay, is it doing better than that? I mean, that was another story that really needed writing.
Yes, Seward is doing better than that. I think the Civil War is. Or in the 150th anniversary, and that helps. The Lincoln movie helps. And Seward is a more colorful character. People sometimes ask me if you could have dinner with either of them, with whom would you have dinner? And the answer is, for sure, Seward. He would just be much more fun and dramatic to spend a few hours with.
But I think he would drone on. That's what everybody says. First off, he doesn't dress very well. Second off, he's very fond of cigars. And he has a way of droning on.
Yes, but if you could get him to drone on interesting topics, like why he was interested in Alaska or the ins and outs of the Alaska negotiation, it would be fascinating to sit and listen to him.
I would love to take him to Lake Hood and tell him about all the big cargo planes that were coming in over on the other side of the lake, and they were carrying cargo from China to other places that never really would see any place but that part of Alaska, and that the fuel for those airplanes was coming in refined in North Pole, Alaska, and coming in by rail and being put into a pipe. He would love all that stuff. Really?
That would shut him up. Where we started. I think, in general, he'd be very proud to see what Alaska has become, and that that it's a state of the union, et cetera.
Yeah, and it's fascinating that he arrives in Alaska not long after the purchase and predicts it'll become a state. I mean, that just completely blows my mind.
Well, he was one in thinking that with the Army. If you read Major General Halleck, who was head of what was called then the Department of the Columbia, which included Alaska, he issued a statement in 1867 to the naval captain. Well, it's actually an Army general, Columbus Davis, who came up on the USS Jamestown to oversee the official transfer. In his instructions, Halleck's instructions to Davis, he says, undoubtedly this will follow the territorial path of other places in the West, and we will see a civilization there, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I think it was fairly common thinking at the time.
Yeah, military is a big part of exploring Alaska when you really look into it, Signal Corps and the mapping and all that stuff.
They did it all.
Yeah, looking for where is the mineral resources, and very good, accurate at it, as it
very
turned
much.
Out. 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK. A local call from Anchorage at 550-8422. Email talk@alaskapublic.org. Our two historians differ, but maybe not anymore. Maybe they've resolved it, on whether or not bribery was involved in the Alaska purchase. And I guess to lay it out, there's $7 million. Everybody knows that. But there's this extra money that was given to the Russian ambassador. And it's kind of a question as whether he was laundering it and using it for bribery or not. And it's complicated. Wouldn't you say, Walter Starr, that it's complicated because you can't really trust what the newspapers are saying? I mean, this is an era during the Johnson administration in which slander of all sorts was being slapped around in the press. And you had captive media. I mean, Seward damn near owned the New York Times. He could get anything he wanted put in there. Scandalous, absolutely scandalous.
Well, I guess Seward's response would be, well, if the other side has its captive newspaper, surely I have to have some right of reply.
Yeah, I know.
And bear in mind, in these days, the New York Times is a comparatively modest newspaper. It's not the New York Times as we think of it. It's sort of, I don't know, third, fourth tier newspaper, but it was consistently friendly with Seward from an early date.
And you just figure that you pretty well nailed it, and you are a lawyer by background, that you pretty well nailed it, that some of this money had to go, I think, to what, senators to end
well,
up with?
The Senate process happens very quickly after the treaty is signed. The Senate ratifies, and the vote is 37-2. And so I'm not at all sure that money goes to senators for the Alaska Treaty. Impeachment, that's a different question, because it's the House of Representatives that's much harder for Alaska, because, as we've been saying, this is playing out at the same time as impeachment, and by the time the House votes nearly a year later as to whether to pay the promised $7.2 million, Johnson and Seward are much less popular. And the prime evidence that some of the money goes to some members of the House of Representatives is two statements that Seward himself makes with slightly different details, but two statements that he makes within a couple weeks of the events, one to the president and one to a New York friend, John Bigelow, both of which the people think are sufficiently dramatic that they write them down right away.
Hey, Cox, what do you make of that?
Well, it's interesting. I learned my American diplomatic history from another historian who's written about this, Paul S. Holbo at the University of Oregon, in a book he called Tarnished Expansion. The key evidence, as Walter says, are the statements that Seward is reported to have made, one to the president, Andrew Johnson, and the other to John Bigelow. Holbo says about Johnson that he was a tippler and liked to exaggerate. And so it robs that statement of some credibility, perhaps. With Bigelow, I think Holbo may be on shakier ground in dismissing Bigelow's statement. But again, doesn't seem to be any follow-up where Bigelow is involved. Holbo goes on to take a look and see, well, what happened? Did any money show up in Thaddeus Stevens' bank account or in Nathaniel Bank's bank account or in any of the other people purported to have got money? And there's no evidence there. Now, that's hardly conclusive. I don't know that even if you were an attorney, you'd introduce that if you had a case before you.
Well, Thaddeus Stevens might have died in the intervening time, though.
Might have, but he was alive at the time that the bribes would have taken place if there were bribes. So Paul Holbo may have been a little bit casual in dismissing this evidence. We don't have anything that Seward wrote down himself in his own diary, I don't believe. What we have are people who wrote down what they thought they heard him say, either in an alcohol-fueled haze or because their imaginations were working overtime. But maybe it was accurate. I think there is still a little bit of question there. But I think that Walter did a wonderful job of explaining the situation and going through the evidence.
I agree. In a lot of ways, this book, Seward, Lincoln's Indispensable Man, is almost a transitional piece of history. There will be other biographies. I want to know about the lavish entertainments that he was always putting on. Who was doing the cooking? What were they serving? There's just so many details, so much color in this, that just by there's so many facts and history you have to go through here, Walter Starr, that you have to skimp on a lot of these details. But that will tell you this: the book comes alive every time you quote Henry Adams.
Yes.
Now there's a writer.
Yes, and there were some other quotes of Henry Adams and his brother Charles Francis Jr. and their father Charles. If I had world enough in time, I might write a book just about the Adams family during the Civil War, because they're fascinating folks and they write well and they all keep diaries as well as sending one another letters. And part of what makes the Henry Adams quotes great is that a number of them are from later in life, as he looks back on Seward, this sort of larger-than-life figure that he knew when he, Henry, was just a boy in Washington in the secession winter.
Yeah, it's fascinating. I kind of cramming this book faster than I really would have liked to have read it. I was smelling the locomotive steam. I was like bathed in the feel of the era, the tobacco soaked drapes. what a time it was, and so much maneuvering. I mean, it's one thing that Seward was good at was tap dancing. He seems to have realized that this was going to be his calling at some point, and decided this was going to be his life. He was going to be pulling strings and making things happen. And there's editorial cartoons and so forth that nail it, wouldn't you say?
Yes. No. He from a very young age, Seward sort of sees. Becomes a lawyer and works away as a lawyer, but politics is, from a very young age, is what fascinates him, it continues right up till the day he dies. Dies kind of in the midst of the 1872 presidential campaign, and even though he says that he's not interested and not going to participate, he can't quite help himself.
And so he starts out as a Whig, and then he's a Republican, and then the Republicans hate him, and he's sort of allied with the Democrats. It's very, very interesting. And then he ends up Republican again.
Yes. And indeed, even before he's a Whig, before there is a Whig party, he's an anti-Mason, and he's a
national Union
man.
And what the hell is that? Does that have to do with the burned-over stuff? I mean, I know about Masons, and let me tell you, there's definitely stuff to be anti about that.
Anti-Masonry does arise in the burned-over district. There's this lapsed Mason, William Morgan, who threatens to reveal the secrets and then disappears one night and is presumed murdered. But the investigation into his disappearance and death gets impeded at every stage.
Oh, wow. Now, I want that book. And while you're at it, if you do the Masons book, look into the Johnstown Flood. You'll find a connection there as well. As Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from this APRN member station. Salmon Love presents the Salmon Haiku Contest through April 30th. Do you have a poetic, funny, and creative Alaska salmon haiku in you like this one? Fresh fry awakens, moving through ripples. Silently, an epic journey blossoms. That's Salmon Love Haiku Style. Information on how to enter the Salmon Haiku Contest at salmonlove.com. This message sponsored by the Salmon Project.
Well, we're blasting through 150-year-old history as fast as we can, and Charles joins the program from Lake Minchumina. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Charles.
Hello.
Howdy.
I'm interested in stories of exploration, too. I believe the Shenandoah was the first steam-powered, screw-driven vessel to circle the globe. And also, I think it was fired the last shot in the war in Alaska here.
Yeah, yeah, long after the war was over. They claimed that people tell them they didn't believe people when they told them the war was over. And it kept going and destroying whaling vessels. Yeah, that's absolutely true. It doesn't ever come up in Starr's book. I suspect, however, that Mr. Haycox knows a bit about it.
It's very interesting. Those whaling ships that the Shenandoah captured were worth a lot of money. And, of course, the Union cause needed every dime it could get, as people do in war. And the Shenandoah was just out of touch. It was the CSA Shenandoah sailing in the Bering Sea in 1865 and 1866. The war is long over, and the poor captain of the Shenandoah doesn't find out until finally he is overwhelmed by the number of Yankee whaling captains who tell him, and finally somebody shows him a newspaper headline.
And then he sneaks all the way back. All the way back to England. That's an astonishing story.
Was that captain's name Waddell or Weddell or something
Yeah,
like that?
Yeah, that was Waddell. Yeah.
That's the guy.
And he was afraid to go back to an American port for fear he'd be court-martialed, which he probably would have been. Sure. So he took off for England.
Boy, howdy. Charles, thanks for bringing that one up.
Thanks.
All right. Yeah, did you ever hear of that one, Walter Starr?
I did. As you might imagine, that led to a little bit of diplomatic correspondence between Seward and the British, but that was one of those that just didn't quite, you know, rise to the level that to get into the book.
And of course it was after the war.
I know it's a long book, but it was once a longer book.
Oh, I believe that. And I guess we should really bring up, in fairness, just for the historical context, the importance of cotton to the British interest.
Yes, the British were, before the war, importing, huge amounts of cotton from the United States, and that was one reason that the Southerners felt that the British would recognize them as independent almost immediately. They they were wrong in that, in part because the British had imported so much that they had surplus on their hands as the war started, and in part because the British quite quickly developed alternative sources of supply.
As you were writing this book, Walter Starr, what do you think was the biggest surprise you got about Mr. Seward? I mean, you surprised me nine ways, you know, all over the place. But for you, you know, the big one, the biggie.
The big one. Well, I think it's something that we've already touched on, this sort of all of these other territorial ambitions and efforts after the Civil War. I knew of Alaska. I knew that was going to be part of my story from the day I started doing the research. But I didn't know anything about Seward and the Panama Canal Zone and Seward and British Columbia until I got into the process. And then I began to see Alaska as just sort of, you know, at least in Seward's mind, kind of a piece in the puzzle. Now, as it turned out, he only got that one very large piece, and a bunch of other things fell through. But Alaska looks different when you see it in the context of all of these other intended, negotiated, in some cases, signed up agreements to acquire other territory.
Yeah. Professor Haycox, I would imagine you probably learned from Mr. Starr's book how much Seward's successors, his disciples almost, ended up completing his territorial expansion aspirations. It's pretty amazing, isn't it?
It is amazing. Of course, there was, as Hobel pointed out, a hiatus. But then with the Spanish-American War and Josephus Daniels and Theodore Roosevelt and Admiral Dewey, I mean, suddenly America has this effective worldwide empire, which quite realized Seward's ambition for a commercial American presence in the Orient. And of course, we're still dealing with that today. There are a couple of interesting local connections I might call our listeners' attention to very quickly, if I might. One,
please.
Well, Andy Muldoon died 15 years ago or so, and he left a bequest to the city. He wanted a Seward statue because Anchorage didn't have one. And so it was commissioned, and it stands today at the entrance of the Lusac Library. And people can go look at it, school children particularly. Teachers can take them out to the library, and they can take a look at Mr. Seward, a fairly jaunty pose. It catches him in mid-stride. Walter, I think you thought that he might have been a little too slim in that statue.
Hard to say. Some authors described him as you know, sort of 120 pounds and barely filling the clothes he was wearing. So perhaps at some points in his life he is that slim. But yeah, it was a good statue.
Danielle weighs in by email saying, I visited the Seward House in Auburn and I cannot recommend it highly enough. It's one of my favorite historic house museums because it never left the Seward family, and it's full of Seward's original books, art correspondence, even has an Alaska room. They give wonderful guided tours. It goes on to recommend Team of Rivals, which probably we would all echo. Let's go to David in Homer. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, David.
Thank you, Steve. I just wanted to call just to give a little anecdote. I live in Homer. I'm a retired psychology university professor, and one of my professors who was on my doctoral committee was John P. Seward, who was a direct descendant of Secretary Seward. And by the way you have described Secretary Seward, John Seward was tall, very slender, but a very kind and quiet and gentle man, a world-famous psychologist, but apparently with a disposition quite different from his great-great-great or whatever it was, the grandfather.
Oh, he was a pretty good psychologist.
He was. Oh, you mean Seward? Both of them. Yeah, both of them were.
But I'm not sure kind and gentle would be the first adjective that I would reach for when describing Secretary Seward.
Right. It just goes to show how genes get mixed up over the years of various unions.
Yeah. Well, of course, his wife was, she was very kind and gentle, so.
But that's probably where it came from.
Yeah. Let's, Ben joins the program from No Attack, Alaska. I was hoping we'd get a call from Seward. I don't know if we're going to do it. Ben, welcome to Talk of Alaska. Hello, Ben in No Attack? Is he gone? We lost Ben. Still time for Seward to come through here in the last couple of minutes. We got Steve Haycox and Walter Starr here with us, and we're talking William Henry Seward.
I would echo, by the way, the comment of your emailer that the Seward House Museum in Auburn is just a wonderful place and really brings Seward to life and shows his his connection with Alaska. He brought back a lot of loot from Alaska, and a lot of it is still there.
Okay, Ben is on connected now. Ben, welcome to Talk of Alaska from No Attack.
Yeah, I'm listening to part of, I didn't listen to the first part of it, but I'm just wondering, at what cost do indigenous people that state of Alaska is purchased on? Or, something to that effect. I haven't heard any of the natives being mentioned in the program.
Yeah, we did.
Question.
We started some of that at the beginning and didn't ever really come back around to it like I thought we would, Ben. But essentially they were ignored, wouldn't you say, pretty much, Walter Starr?
There was neither the Russians nor the Americans were very concerned about the native people in this negotiation. Steve, would you agree with that?
Oh, I would. The Tlingit did make a representation, actually, at the time of the ceremonial transfer on October the 18th and around that time, wondering how it was that they were not included in the negotiation and not part of the ceremony as they viewed it as their land. And the U.S. courts eventually, 100 years later, would determine that, in fact, the Tlingit did have a concept of property ownership and that it needed to be compensated. But that was 100 years after the fact.
So we end the show the way we began it. Thank you so much, Walter Starr.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, great. It's great to talk with you, and I'm so glad that you have written this book. Steve Haycox, thanks for helping shed the light from your angle.
A pleasure to be here, and Walter, a pleasure to talk with you again.
Great. I hope you get back up here. And thanks so much for those who ventured to call on this program. Thanks to Monica Gokey, Josh Edge, and Tristan Sammons. I'm Steve Heimel.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network and by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating jobs and business opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Hope Community Resources has been a part of Alaska for more than 45 years, providing assistance to Alaskans with disabilities. Information on all Hope services and mental health supports is available at hopealaska.org. This message is sponsored by Hope Community Resources. This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.